What up, Primers? JC here. Can't get enough of Footy Prime, the podcast? Why not head over to Footy Prime's YouTube? Head to youtube.com/Footy Prime for exclusive video content. Then make your way over to wearefootyprime.com for all things Footy Prime, including our official gear from Admiral and our One Ball Gin from Nickel 9 Distillery. And make sure to follow and subscribe across all platforms, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to TikTok. Footy Prime has got you covered for all things footy. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the show. You're listening to Footy Prime, the podcast, with Danny the Manny Dicchio, Greg has a third leg Forrest, and Charmin, Jimmy Charmin. Today, we welcome Benoit Giroux, TFC's legendary own. For Dan Wong, the producer extraordinaire, and myself, Jeff Cole, let's get it on.
Was that Manny Danny, and he's got a third leg Forrest? Was that what you said there?
Well, I just go by what I know.
And I'm Jimmy. I feel let down here. Like, Jesus.
Oh, you're Charmin. Jimmy Charmin.
I was happy with mine.
Yeah, I bet you were.
A lot of ladies have said that too.
Welcome to Footy Prime, the podcast. We're back in numbers, and it should be a really fun one today. A great guest in a few minutes' time. Benoit Giroux, one of Toronto FC's legends, a championship winner, and a man who, when he came on the field for TFC, the entire stadium went, "Ah, oh, thank Christ. Oh, someone who's calm and collected and can actually string a pass together." That was Benoit when he came on the field for TFC. We'll get to a lot with him very shortly. But fellas, let's begin by getting your thoughts on what has been a great weekend, considering the situation around the world. The German Bundesliga is back. Empty stadiums, sterilized balls, which I'm assuming means the football's in the field. I don't know. I can't guarantee that. Masks on the sidelines, social distancing, and as I said, no fans in the stadiums. Did you enjoy it, fellas? Was it weird? Was it what you thought it might be?
It reminded me of playing for the Canadian national team.
No fans in the stands?
Yeah, there was actually more in the stands today than there were back in the day.
Oh, you're a cruel man, Greg. Cruel man.
No, you know what? I did enjoy it. It was great watching anything. And obviously today, Bayern Munich, a little rusty, but showing their class. And it was like watching a practice match with lots of quality. Except for Union Berlin, I thought they were decent. They held on. They huffed and puffed, but they lacked a lot of quality in the final third. Deitch.
Yeah, I felt sorry for them a little bit because they defended pretty well, but I think Bayern were just in kind of gear three at the time and just pushing on. But it was strange for me. It was weird. There's a lot of weird stuff going on at the moment. I have no idea with certain stuff why substitutes have to sit 10 yards apart, why players have to wear masks going out for the warm-up, why...
It's called COVID-19, Deitch.
No, but I'm going to explain why do players have to separate themselves when they score a goal from 10 yards away, but from a corner kick, they're fucking elbowing each other and grappling each other. It doesn't make sense to me. So you're either going full out, the players have all been tested, they're all fine, so let them go full out. If they score a goal, let them celebrate.
I know. You know what? Did you watch yesterday?
Let them fight. If the substitutes want to sit next to each other, let them sit next to each other.
On Saturday, it was weird because certain games, I think the Freiburg game, they were celebrating like normal. There was no difference. But then the other games, they were having that distancing. So some teams, it's not like a strict order, apparently. It's just like a suggestion. You know, we don't recommend that you celebrate as usual. But I agree with you. You're right. Corners... it's football, that there's tackles being thrown in there. Nothing changes. There's body to body contact continuously. There's going to be saliva and spit everywhere. It's football. What difference does it make? But I guess they'll grow into it. And every league right now is watching this and saying this could be the blueprint for the near future. Do you think this can work elsewhere? Is it going to work elsewhere? Is this
what I think you're right, Charms, but I think the bigger picture isn't what happens on the football field or any other sporting event for that matter like this. It's going to be whether there's a second wave or, you know, as things get relaxed in the communities, because we're already seeing in Canada, United States for sure, they're just saying, fuck with it. Let's go. You know, we're going to ride this thing out. And if there is a big second wave, it'll be shut down regardless of what happens. But yes, other leagues will be looking at that for the time being, that if things go well and there isn't a massive second wave, that we can move on to some normality, as including football.
And Deitch, I'll say this, you know, despite there not being these 6-7 week pre-seasons, which you were demanding, the play looked half decent, didn't you think?
No.
Oh, no. Come on. But you wanted 2 months preseason, didn't you? Yeah, for a guy who hated preseason, you're like,
I know, exactly.
I hate preseason. Benoit would tell you I hated preseason. Benoit hated preseason as well. Players hate preseason, but you cannot go into a full season or like the finish of the season with not playing against any opposition. So I don't know. It's still bizarre to me. I still think maybe they've come back a little bit too early. I'm happy that football is back on. Don't get me wrong, but I still feel that there's a lot of stuff that is going to be happening, whether it be injuries, long-term injuries I'm talking about, not just muscle injuries that are going to keep you out for 2 weeks. I think there's going to be loss of form. Some players are going to get found out or that they're not back at full fitness, and maybe they're up at the end of the year with their contract and they've shown their cards, and the owners are going now, well, maybe this fella's not worth a contract. So there's a lot of stuff going on. There's rules in England as well with the Premier League, and you just spoke about spitting and stuff like that. They're talking about when you make a slide tackle to turn your face the other way, so that you're not in.
Come on,
distance. Like,
that's ridiculous.
Who even thinks this shit? That's so much crap going on. Just let the game be played how it should be played. Test the players. Make sure it's all clean. You've done all that stuff off the field, but when they go on the field, once they go onto the pitch, over the white line, it's done. It's normal football.
5 subs as well in Germany. So you saw, I think, obviously more tactical subs even at halftime. If this continues, 5 subs in football games, will you see more subs at halftime? Will being subbed up at halftime be less embarrassing than perhaps it has been?
What, staying with the 5 substitutes, you mean?
Yeah, at least in the short term anyway, going forward.
Oh, I think they will do for the short term. I think it's a good idea. I think, you know, Deitch is right about injuries there. So you have to look at the authorities and think that FIFA, UEFA, whoever it is, are doing whatever they can to protect the players. And by giving an extra substitution or two, they would certainly be helping in that category. The play today was certainly rusty, like I said, but and there were some late challenges, kind of lunging in challenges, I thought were maybe down to rust that could cause injury. But then on the other hand, some of the Berlin players, I don't know, are up to the standard anyway.
It'd be interesting to hear as well, like what Benoit says about France and what they're seeing over there, because obviously Germany is very close to them as well. They've gone ahead with their league. But to hear the different reactions in France as well, like from not only the players, the staff, but also the federation, the fans, what they feel.
Yeah, well, let's bring on Benoit now. Benoit Cheroux, former Lille, Auxerre, Marseille, and of course Toronto FC, a 4-time French Cup champion, a Ligue 1 champion, and of course an MLS Cup champion. Benoit, welcome to Footy Prime. Thanks so much for joining us from France. Let me ask you this. Football was cancelled in France. Has that been generally accepted by the football fans, or you know, watching Germany this weekend, is that painful for French football fans?
Of course, it's painful, but it's a kind of example for football, soccer in Europe. We're all watching what's going on in Germany. But like everybody says, this football is different from what we expect from the game, because the game seems different because of these rules and stuff. And I think the good decision has been made by a French government to say, okay, we stop the French league now until end of August. And I feel like I'm more comfortable with that decision regarding what's going on in Germany. You guys said that maybe if something wrong happened in a couple of days or weeks, the demand can sell as well. So risk have been taken. We'll see. But it's very new for all of us, and we have to figure it out now.
I know, following other leagues, other countries right now, there's a concern that when football returns, say in England, it will look very different, as far as some clubs won't make it through this. They're going to fall, go bankrupt, whatever it is. Will French football look different, do you think, once it returns later this year?
It's all about TV rights.
TV rights, yeah, sure, absolutely. That being one of them.
This is the big deal, because TV in France didn't want to pay the whole amount they have to pay, because they paid for 38 games. 38 days with 10 games each days. So they had only 29 or 30, I think. So TV said, okay, we don't have all the game we have paid for, so we don't pay for the all amount we should. So the league have the authorization by the government to have like a mortgage to help the clubs to pay the players, people working for the clubs now, until football get back in August. So the league have done a lot for French clubs to be able to go through this period with very difficult.
How about the lower divisions, Benoit? We know in the UK, in England, in Scotland, that the lower division clubs that rely on gates as opposed to TV rights, how are they doing in France? And is there any government support for football at the lower divisions?
Yes, that kind of same stuff as for first division and second division. And then the third division is not full professional. It's half professional. So the league helps the third division as well, but it's difficult for all the clubs in France. Yeah.
Benoit, so you live in Paris at the moment, okay? An interesting story with PSG, because they have been given the championship by the federation because the league has been cancelled. But they've also said that they still want to play in the Champions League. Now, what is the process with that? Are they still training at the moment? Are they going to play their games in, obviously, a different part of France or in another country? I don't know if you have any information you can tell us.
No, the big deal so far was getting back people, players like Neymar, Thiago Silva, who've been in Brazil to do the lockdown with their family in their country. Okay. So the big deal for PSG was to get this guy back in France to the training ground, training facilities. But the process is very difficult. They can train only 4 or 5 players each day. No meeting between these guys. So they haven't started yet collective training now. But they are waiting for the date as well for the Champions League game. So okay. A lot of confusion about that.
Benoit, talking about the actual system in France, what's really interesting is that in France, you guys create amazing players. It's a revolving door of talent. Why is it that France is so strong in those areas and they export some of the very best players in the world as opposed to some other European countries? Like my England.
Yeah, my opinion is we have a lot of good coaches in young young age, even in smaller clubs. I think, Ditch, you've seen how we work in France at the French Football Federation. And the courses as well for coaches are very good. And I feel like a lot of players start in the street as well, which is very important to develop a lot of skills. In terms of technique and all this stuff. And as it's not the biggest league as well, French clubs needs to produce a lot of young players to sell it, to sell them, sorry, to make money, because the TV rights are not as good as as big as in England or Germany or Spain. So this is the way for the clubs to produce money as well.
And Clairefontaine, I guess, became the blueprint for many nations, how to develop young talent. And it's just been a conveyor belt for years now. But, you know, you mentioned how teams need to develop young French talents, but then you have a team like PSG, for example, who enjoy the riches of the state of Qatar, and since 2011 have really dominated French football. It's obviously put a face on French football globally, but is it good for French football, do you think, the PSG model and what they've done?
I think it's good for France, for the football in France, that PSG became one of the biggest clubs in Europe now. They have a lot of money to buy players like Mbappe, like Neymar, but they produce as well a lot of young and good players. They've sold last summer window market for about 80 million euros. Young players who've been to Monaco, in Germany, in Leipzig, Dortmund. So the PSG Academy is really good as well. The team is too good to have young players from the Academy right now in the first team in PSG, but they had Rabiot, who played now for Juventus, Kimpembe as well. And I think PSG is very important for the football in France, because they have a lot of money, but they work well as well.
Going back to the actual development of younger players as well, and as part of my EFCL course, which the MLS put on a coaching course for coaches within the academies in MLS, and our headquarters was the Federation in Clairefontaine. And to see the work that coaches, they don't even call coaches in France, they call them formateurs. You're basically a teacher, a person that's trying to guide a younger player through certain scenarios and situations, whether it be on the field, even off the field, mentally, cognitively. And it was just a totally different way of coaching that I was so, so fortunate to be a part of, because I was brought up in the old English way of, we're going to shout at you as much as possible and try to get the best out of you. We're going to use that scare tactic that we talk about in England. But in France, it was a total new methodology in the way they taught their younger players. And Benoit's right. There were a lot of fantastic coaches that have either played the game over there or they've studied the game for a long, long time. And they're very interested in the game. They're invested in the game. They're invested in youth as well. And that's the big part for me. They have a lot of coaches that are invested in trying to develop younger players. They're not looking at their career of, oh, I want to be in the first team or I want to be in the national team next year. They're invested in that group of players or that age group for a long period of time. And they've developed, I think France is probably the number one export of players throughout the world. And you can bring Brazil in that, but Brazil send players everywhere. But if you're looking at where French players are going in Europe and to what clubs they are going, they're probably the number one export. And on the counter to that as well, and Benoit will vouch for me, in and around Paris and Marseille as well, they have these small cities where they're underprivileged areas and they are still playing a lot of street football. And that's something you don't see in a lot of big countries anymore. Even in England, Italy, I speak to my family over there, you don't see a lot of kids playing football in the street. But in these small areas now, whether they're immigrant areas or areas from low-income families where they've got a ball and they're playing on the concrete field with like...
Yeah. Was it Mahrez? Mahrez was a street player, wasn't he?
Mahrez. But Benoit grew up with a lot of those guys as well that came through either those street football areas and they've developed into... And sometimes it's tough for them guys because all they want to do is control the ball and play with the ball all the time. And to put them in a team setting... It's very, very difficult. So it's a mental aspect then. But I have a lot of adulation for what they're doing in France, and they will continue to do it in France. And I think being in England last year at St. George's, they're trying to go along the similar lines of bringing small-sided games in at younger age groups and not too much coaching, a lot of let them play, let's guide them into certain scenarios and situations, and let them figure it out as youngsters. And that's why we're seeing a steady influx of younger players coming through in England as well now.
Well, you guys both work the youth system here in Canada, and Danny, you're still well involved with it with Toronto FC. What are the challenges, and how can Canada get to the next step? Forget about getting to the level of the French, but what do you guys think about getting us to a level where we can compete at least to, you know, strongly in CONCACAF on a regular basis?
You want to ask first, Benoit?
No, go on, Danny.
For me, it's all about competition, Craig, and how much the Federation is willing to spend on their youth. And for me, like, if you want to develop players and put them in situations or games or experience where you're not just picking a team and throwing them into a tournament and hoping for the best, you have to prepare that age group or that team for 2 to 3 years against good opposition. There's no point just bringing a team of under 16 Canada international players together for 1 week of training and then sending them into CONCACAF tournaments, Greg, and hoping they compete against Mexico or the US. We've had 20 games against stellar opposition for 2 years.
Well, you're absolutely right, Danny, but it comes down for the Canadian Soccer Association. It comes down to finances. They haven't got the money. Mm-hmm. And where does the money come from to be able to do that on a regular basis when they watch the southern neighbors, the United States, just putting all this money, lots of corporate backing, Adidas puts money into programs, and they developed. And the guys are together months. Like Nick Dazovich has his under 20 Canadian team back in the day. They show up at a tournament 5 days before. Meanwhile, the U.S. have been boarding together for 6 months preparing for the same tournament. What chance have we got?
Well, it's also, you know, I mean, listen, France is a football culture. We know it's been around for a long, long time, right? It's still in its infancy in Canada, and it's frustrating. We all know that, but, you know, it's baby steps. Benoit, you look at the current French team, and we know there's great young talent. You know, Mbappe just is the one that stands out amongst all others. He's a kid still, really, and he's going to be arguably the best player in world football very, very soon. But beneath him, is there another wave of very young, great French talent coming through? Is this current team going to be infused by Euro next year with yet more young talent?
Yes, I think, like I said, in France, a lot of clubs need to produce a lot of talent, a lot of players to sell them in bigger clubs, bigger leagues, because they need it to survive. So the way they produce a young player is very important, and a lot of young players are coming as well behind Mbappé. Even if I feel like we have only one Mbappé for 3 or 4 decades, maybe. But we have a lot of good players. I think the French league is one of the youngest league in Europe because of that, because they cannot pay players as much as they get paid in Germany, in Spain, or in England. So they have to sell them, and the teams are very young. Yeah. So we have a lot of young players coming.
Frightening for most nations, because I think France would have been the favourites at Euro this year and likely will be next year, and still great players coming through. France also develops great coaches. We've known that for a long time. And if I look back at your career, a decade ago, you're a French champion at Marseille under Didier Deschamps. You know, obviously, he's a legend as a footballer and as a coach now. What was he like to play under on a day-to-day basis?
I felt lucky to have Didier Deschamps as a coach for 3 years, 3 seasons. We won the French league with this coach. He has won everything in his career as a player and as a coach as well. He's very pragmatic. He always wants to win, and he doesn't have any tight idea about the way he wants his team to play. He's not feeling more comfortable about 4-4-2 or 4-3-3. It depends on the players he has. And the opposition as well, the team in front of us. So yes, he's very pragmatic. I think he's his best quality, and he never quits. He never give up, which is a great quality for a coach. And he gave us a lot of energy and confidence as well to perform.
You know, it must have been an amazing time for you at that time with Marseille, Benoit. And then as your career after that, you moved on eventually to Toronto FC. And what a difference. Obviously, a team that's known throughout the world, winning championships at the top end of the French, of European leagues. And then you come to a relatively new league and relatively new club. What was the experience like that for you coming to Canada?
It was obviously a great experience, successful as well. I was lucky to be a part of this group, of this club organization as well. I've been welcomed as a part of the city, of the club, and I'm very thankful for that. I'm very proud to be a part of all this success as a player with Toronto FC. And coming from Europe, coming from Marseille, I wanted to share my experience as a player. I was 33 years old when I came, and it was a good timing for me to have a new experience. And this one was very different, obviously, from what I've done and I've been through in Europe and in France. But it has been a wonderful experience for me, a lot of success, and I wanted to build something. And coming from like the bottom, I can say, because it was the first time TFC qualified for playoffs, the first season I've played for TFC. And then step by step, the first final against Seattle, and then the revenge against Seattle was absolutely amazing for me to be a part of this experience and this adventure.
And while we have to speak about that 2017 year, because the year that we first won the championship, there was a lot of disappointment the year before, because I know that as a group and as a club, we felt that we played well enough to win that final. And then obviously on penalty kicks is a very, very difficult way to lose. But the team came back in a kind of real mental state that they were going to clear everything up out of their heads and go through and be mentally strong to win the next final. But I have to say, personally, the Montreal game, TFC Montreal series, was probably the best atmosphere I've ever been at in North America. And I've been to a few games, I've played in a few games, been as a supporter, even going to Montreal, the old the Olympic stadium there was a fantastic experience, not the result, but the home game where you obviously scored the header as well. What a fantastic experience. What was that like compared to like a European game? I'm not talking about in the Velodrome in Marseille where you have 60,000, but it was comparable, I thought, to a European night, that the most close we would ever see in North America.
Yes, I totally agree, Danny. Something was weird for me coming from Europe to North America. When we played away, there was a very few amount of fans, and I was not used to have this stadium empty. I always used to play in front of a full stadium, obviously, but with our fans. And when we play for Toronto, we have fans only when we play against Columbus, maybe New York City, New York Red Bull a little bit, and obviously in Montreal. So the atmosphere is totally comparable when we play this kind of game, this rivalry, and the atmosphere is there in Montreal, but in Toronto, in front of our fans, where was amazing. And these memories, I keep them in my heart and my head, and it's very big memories in my entire career, for sure.
What was it like, Benoit, transitioning from coming to the end of your career? You obviously could feel that coming, like we all do, But transitioning from that to, you know, everyday life, getting involved, still involved in football. But how was that for you?
I felt good with that because I understood that coming from Europe at 33, most of my career was behind me and not in front of me. But I wanted to share my experience. And MLS Canada in Toronto, especially with that project, wanted to be one of the biggest clubs in North America. Was a perfect fit for me because I wanted to help the club to improve young players and bring my my experience. Either I'm on the field, or on the bench, or in the stands, trying to help the team, trying to talk to the young players and help the team to perform and to be better. That's all I wanted to do coming from Europe. And I feel like I helped the team to make it. And these 3 years for me have been amazing. Yeah.
As a European joining Toronto FC, was it difficult to emerge from the shadow that was Danny Dicchio?
Yes, especially because of his technique with the header.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I thought you meant. Actually his shadow.
Hey, well, you know the goal that Benoit scored against Montreal. That was the only time he scored with his head in his career.
Was it really?
Yeah. I watched a lot of videos from Danny to make it.
Yeah, all 14 games. Yeah. Must have taken a long time.
And a half, actually, Sean.
Oh, sorry. All right, fair enough. So when you recommend to a young French player that coming to MLS might be a good career choice to develop, to learn, or would you still say, you know, if you can stay in France, you know, cut your teeth there before making a move?
You have to think about a lot of things. You know, I'm not another person. My feeling at that moment when I came, it was a good timing for me. But for Seba, we have a lot of talk about that with Seba Jovinko. He was younger than me. He had a different contract as well, different way of mind. And what he's done for the club and for the league was amazing. Not a lot of people at his level came at his prime, but for French players, I think there will be more and more French players to come to MLS, especially because of the new CBA. The contract is comparable at what a lot of players can have in first division, second division. So I think it's good for the league as well to develop that aspect of the game behind the scene, because it's not a secret. If you want to have more players from Europe, you have to pay them as much as they can pay in mm-hmm. in Europe, and that's it. But the experience is really different, and a lot of French players and players from Europe look the MLS in a different way now.
Do you think having Thierry Henry coaching in Montreal this season, it seems so long ago now, doesn't it? But do you think that will help bring, perhaps encourage French players to come over and try?
Yes, for sure. Thierry Henry is a big name in Canada and US, but in France as well. So in even if in the French medias, we talk a lot of about Montreal, about MLS because of Thierry Henry. So it could help to bring some French player to have Thierry Henry coaching Montreal.
For sure. Got me thinking. I mean, Henry, obviously one of the great French players of all time, but I think it's probably fair to say that it's either Platini or Zidane as the two greatest French players. It's in my opinion, who do you lean towards? Who's your guy? Is it Zizou or is it Platini?
I'm too young to
yeah, exactly.
to say that. Yeah, I've watched Platini, yes, on videos, but Zidane, for sure, yes. I was a young kid watching these amazing players. I was lucky to go to a lot of games for the World Cup 98 in Stade de France because I was living just close by. So I've seen many games of Zidane, and Yes, for me, he's the best player ever for the French national team.
But you're great. You're much older than we are. I mean, are you more a Platini guy or a Zidane guy?
Easy.
That's too easy. Come on.
Hey, I mean, Platini was, I mean, I was kind of on the, he was on the way out, right?
Yeah.
86 World Cup. Saw him play a few times, obviously, but it's about, you know, exposure and as well as often as Zidane was on television, just a fantastic talent, right?
They had a good team back then as well, France. Alain Giroud, Tigana, very, very good team. And Platini, a lot of people forget how good he was, not only for France, but for Juve as well, where they won a lot of titles. A very, very different type of player than Zizou, who I love as well. I love Zidane, but Platini was an extraordinary player as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that France-Germany game in was it 82, wasn't it? It's 82, I think it was, in the semi-finals, I believe. I mean, I don't remember 82 that well, but I've seen it since. And it is one of the great games, you know, of all time, isn't it?
When the goalkeeper smashed the French striker, huh?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Almost killed him.
Horrendous. There's nothing wrong with that challenge. I mean, that's just...
For goalkeeper, exactly. I wanted to ask you a quick question as well, because we spoke about Deschamps, and there's another coach that you played under that is getting a lot of love, but a lot of attention as well, and that is Bielsa. And I know he coaches in a totally different way than Deschamps. He's very tactically astute, sometimes a little bit old school with his methods. What would you say to us as a player that played under Bielsa? Because he's been successful in some countries, but he hasn't been successful in other countries, in the championship with Leeds now. But what was the difference between the two as a player, from a player's point of view?
It was totally different. And Bielsa is different from all the coaches I've known. His nickname is El Loco, the crazy guy. So I think he's really crazy. And yes, the way he coach, it's difficult to say, but very, very different from all the coaches. The way he communicate as well with the medias, with the fans, with the players, is way different from what I've known with Deschamps and all the other coach.
Is he different in a way, like he speaks differently to the media as what he would speak in his personality in the dressing room? Are those two completely different things?
No, I think his personality is different, and the way his behavior is different as well. Difficult to describe him. But as a coach, he speaks Spanish, he needed a translator. So the message was not as clear as, you know, when you speak the same language. So this is one thing. And then the way he thinks soccer is different. It's very, very different.
Yeah.
I'll say this, though. I mean, no matter what happens in the next few weeks or months, I really hope they find a way to get Leeds back into the Premier League, just for a number of reasons, but I want to see Bielsa in the Premier League, at least for a season. I think it'd be just entertainment value alone would be worthwhile.
A Loco in the Premier League, maybe.
Yeah. It's been a few of them, hasn't there?
Is he a yeller and screamer in the dressing room?
Yes, his behavior is really strange. he deserves his nickname. El Loco is loco, is crazy, yeah. And the way he thinks about soccer, tactically, I can say that he's waiting for the other team to get set and then adapt his tactic and his positioning with the opposition, the opponent. If the opponent play with two strikers, for instance, he wants to play with three center back to have two players marking and one covering, you know. If the other team has only one striker, he wants to play with two center back. And he can adapt from one game to another game and within the game as well. So that's why he plays frequently with a defensive midfielder who is able to play as a center back as well, and he, who is able to move on forward or backward to help the defense or to have one man extra man in the midfield.
Benoit, I know you've coached, you've done television work as well. What are you going to be working on once football returns to France? What are you hoping to get into from a, you know, staying in that football world?
I want to stay involved in soccer in France. I'm helping as well young kids to develop in a small club where I used to play when I was young. I like it. Players development more than coaching first team, because I feel more comfortable to help young players to develop than to prepare a team to win the game, the next game always, and to manage a first team. I feel more comfortable with young players, and working for TV is new for me. I've done that for 1 year now, but I like it, and I'm very excited each time I go all around Europe to commentate some games, to see a big stadium, big names, and it's very exciting for me to do that that job.
If you hear about any other jobs available, let us know. Our French, sure. Our French is minimal, but we'll give it a college try.
Hey, listen, if we can do television, anyone can, anywhere. So
that's true.
Benoit, listen, thank you so much. You know, you really were one of the most respected players at Toronto FC, and I know the club misses you. I'm sure you're welcome back anytime. You're definitely welcome back in our podcast anytime. So thank you so much for this.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Benoit. Take care. See you soon. Rich.
Thanks, pal.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That is MLS champion, Ligue 1 champion, Benoit Cheyroux. AD, speaking of TFC, back training this past week individually. We spoke to Ozo, Jonathan Osorio, last week. Have you been up there? How is it? How's the progress?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's coincidentally, I was there on Friday, just to have a look at the process, because there's obviously a lot of stuff and moving parts which is going on to get the players onto the field, but they're having to go through individual screening prior to arriving at the training ground. The training facility is closed. So the players are arriving in the car park. They have to stay in their cars before getting called out. Then they have to walk individually for a screening process. They'll be interviewed by one of our medics. Then they'll enter the field area where they're assigned to a quadrant. And I was just overlooking some of the training on Friday, and then Jason Ben asked me to come and help him out. So I was actually working with Osso and Richie Leria and Big Julian Dunn, who's an ex-academy guy as well, and just going through.
So individually you were, or as a group?
So we had them on a quadrant. The field is split up into quadrant, and we could walk in select or kind of like allotted lanes in between the quadrants.
Okay. Is it ball work or just fitness at this point?
A little bit of both. So they've been sent programs which they can do, and we actually timed it. So all four players were working and doing exactly the same thing at the same time. So I could, myself and JB were there. Greg was hovering around both fields as well, just to give some encouragement. But it was basically dribbling, some slalom stuff, stop and turns.
Probably as much to do with the social aspect, isn't it? Just get everybody back, seeing your mates again.
Well, the key thing as well, Craig, you can see them from afar, but you can't really socialize or talk with them. You can shout from your quadrant or just say hi and stuff like that. No really hanging around or lingering around and socializing. You basically do your session. You have an allotted time of an hour. And then you put all your cleats on, you collect all your cones, your soccer balls, and then you have to move off for a different exit because another four players are coming on. So it's very, very well organized. The club have done an excellent thing. But it's tough for the players, I can tell, because they want to socialize, they want to see their mates, they want to they want to see how they're doing. It's just a normal part, I think, of everyday living. But they understand it, and they were working pretty hard. But we start with a second team tomorrow, so we'll see how well it goes with the younger guys.
Is TFC disinfecting its players' balls, like Germany?
Yes.
Everything. So whose job is that?
That is our equipment. I know you'd like to do that, John, wouldn't you?
No, I really wouldn't, actually.
You're a giggling. What a giggling little schoolboy you really are, Sean.
I know. That's a surprise. You come on. Forrest was laughing too. Come on.
Yeah, of course. He's just an older, experienced vet schoolboy.
He's a prefect.
What's that?
He was a prefect.
I don't even know what a prefect is.
In English schools, I'm not sure if they're still there now. Probably not. But it used to be that at a certain age, like 18 or whatever, if you became a prefect, you'd have certain rights and more power, and you could like order the small lowly scum around a little bit more. It's basically a term of authority.
Oh, right. Just kind of moving and feeding the class distinction in England, you mean?
Absolutely. Exactly what it is, yeah.
I see.
Hey, Craig, it was only at private school, so I've never heard of it.
No, we're prefects.
Hey, Deej, I went to there's a golf club in Ipswich, and had a meeting to be a member there.
Yeah.
I was pretty young at Ipswich Town, and they do an interview with you, and you got these old crony golf guys, and they ask you what your father did. Like, what the fuck?
Jesus.
He's a fireman. They went, oh, a fireman. They were so excited. My dad was a fireman. And then they were chatting going on, and I could understand that. No, they thought he was a farmer. They thought I said farmer, not. I corrected them, and I never got a membership.
Jesus, because of your man.
Wow.
Saving lives.
I would never have got in as well, because my dad was a butcher and a debt collector.
He was a cabbie, isn't he?
Yeah, later on, like last couple of years. So,
I can see a Dickie being a debt collector, can't you, Craig? Yeah. Holy crap, intimidating.
Deech was a debt collector on the pitch.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, did you see that Vinnie Jones challenge that was an anniversary on the McMahon at the...
Oh, yeah, it's brilliant. Great.
What happened?
The final against Liverpool.
Yeah, like first 30 seconds, wasn't it?
Off the kickoff, yeah.
When he crushed McMahon.
Crushed him.
Yeah, yeah. So what was this?
It was just an anniversary. So I saw it on Twitter, and I was just like, wow. I mean, like, that's...
And it wasn't even a card, was it? I don't think.
No.
Got a little... Hey, stop that. Because it was literally in the first 15 seconds of the game.
Well, really? Yeah, but today, that guy, I mean, that's a 10-game suspension. And I mean, what would a guy get? Like, that? He's trying to break his leg.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. Absolutely. It's a suspension for sure, and probably jail time.
And then McMahon got him back I don't know if it was a few years later, with kind of the same thing where he wasn't looking Vinnie Jones, and then he turned into him and knocked him to the ground and finished up with an elbow follow through. And Vinnie Jones even said, yeah, he caught him. But he's telling him to get up, right? Because McMahon jumped right up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? Vinnie Jones could play Mr. Dicchio in the movie as the debt collector, couldn't he?
Could do, yeah.
For sure.
Dicchio
could play him.
Yeah. So what happened when...
McMahon was a tough player as well, by the way.
Who? McMahon was very tough, yeah.
Oh, yeah. For sure he was.
Tough cookie. But he was
four forces in that team.
Yeah.
Well, you think Vinnie Jones, how old he was at that time? He was young.
Yeah. He was trying to send a message, Craig. That's what he used to do in those days, didn't he?
First challenge, take him out. The referee would always allow it, yeah.
They won the bloody match, didn't they? So paid off in the end.
Yeah, and today, I mean, he would have been sent off first 30 seconds. I mean, he wouldn't. Yeah. He couldn't survive in the modern game. It's just not a chance.
It'd be lambasted in the media for being a thug and a criminal. And it's just terrible for the kids today to see such terrible...
Are you talking about Deech?
Maybe a little bit. So what happens if someone couldn't pay their debt? What would Mr. Dicchio do to them?
I didn't get involved or ask questions, Craig. Charms.
Really? But you can assume it's pretty ugly, though, right? You come from a family of thugs, is what I'm saying here.
No, not at all. My dad was a butcher until we got to England, and then he had to become a debt collector.
Well, was a debt collector a butcher? Was that some kind of synergy there, you know?
Yeah, but maybe.
Maybe that's
to the... You probably put a few through the meat grinder.
Yeah, exactly. Sweeney Todd. That was probably his nickname.
Probably took his little chopping board knife out with him a couple of times. Yeah.
Hey, have you guys been watching that Barcelona series on Netflix?
I have not. Is it good?
First one.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, it's interesting. Like, Messi doesn't offer much in the way of, you know, outside of the football, of course, in the much way of what he's saying. But Luis Suarez is great. He's still in the show, actually. Smart guy, well-spoken. And, you know, obviously a bit of a team clown. But it's just interesting getting inside that room. And, you know, it's not the Barca of 2011, but it's still a really good team. And
it's pretty cool how they've got that access as well, Shams.
Yeah, it's excellent. It's really good.
Conservative players are not comfortable with it as well. And I think we remember there was a Liverpool one from back in the day. There was a Man City one from a couple of years ago. And you can tell, even with the Sunderland Till I Die one, there's certain players that were in the
squad
that just wanted no part of it.
Lee Cannamore, who's a big part of that team, wasn't even in it, was he?
And I think Messi's kind of similar, but I think Messi has been told that because it's the Barca show or like this behind the scenes with Barca, you have to be in it at some stage. But he doesn't really do any interviews. I mean, the first one I saw was Pique. Suarez was in it a lot, and it was only because Suarez and Messi are best friends.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. They're really close.
Yeah. It was cool, like, to see just a different kind of fans as well, the perspective of fans. There's a guy that's blind that I think he got hurt in an accident, didn't he, Shams?
Yeah, I think he was a firefighter or something, wasn't he?
And it was really cool to see that side of things and how they set up for the derby, their Clásico against Real Madrid, where they won 5-0. But some good stuff, really good stuff. I want to see the Maradona one still, the Napoli.
Oh, that's outstanding.
We haven't really talked about Sunderland Until I Die with you, really.
No, you know what? We're going to get a Sunderland person on for that one because that's a really
good one. What are your initial thoughts on it? Like, I thought from a Canadian sports fan who, you know, has never seen or been to a, you know, kind of understanding what a club can be, I thought it was a pretty good idea. Yeah. I mean, Ipswich, I mean, obviously it was different kind of class, culturally. It was working class, but not at the level of Sunderland. But holy shit, it's amazing what it means to people, eh? Yeah. And I thought I did a good job of doing that.
It's, you know what, when I first kind of watched it, it was for me, being an ex-player, that was probably my best time as a player as well in my career. It was very sad for me, Craig. It was really sad for me because I know how much that club means to people up there. And there's a lot of working class. There's a lot of low-income people up there. There's a lot of people that put literally 50 to 75% of their wages or their income into that club, whether it be through tickets, whether it be through traveling, match day, just all kinds of stuff, because they're so ingrained through their ancestors, their grandparents that love the club, their uncles, their aunties, their mum and dad. It just bites you. Like, you can't get away from it. You ask a lot of them as well. They'll want to get away from it, but they can't. That Saturday, being involved in having to go to the game, and some of them don't even want to go to the game no more, Craig, but they feel that it's such a big community club there, and that's why it was really sad for me, because we had such good times up there, and it's a fantastic club to play for.
It's not that big a place either, really, is it?
Really small. It's a lovely little place on the coast, but it's just sad to see its present predicament and how they're being run and what's going on with the club. That's why
I found it educational, because I knew it was a big club, obviously, but I always thought it was very tiny compared to Newcastle. But actually, obviously, it's a bit smaller than Newcastle, but not considerably. It's still way bigger than I thought it actually was. And, you know, I know you always mentioned, Deitch, on the shows, the community aspect. And I thought they really, really put that across very well. Just what it means to these people who, and as much as they're bitter and angry about certain elements of the club and management and ownership, they really want that club to do well, which sounds like a dumb comment. But a lot of clubs, like Newcastle fans, turned against their club, and I understand why. But even when this team was dropping down divisions, it seemed there's a real love there. You know, they really did believe in the crest in the front, as opposed to the guy, you know, running the ship.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I remember as a player going up to the Northeast, each, it was the same club, I'm sure, as a Londoner going, like, it was Middlesbrough, Sunderland, Newcastle. Those were really tough places. And they're old stadiums, too, like where Roker Park, it just, oh.
Yeah. Like, on the coast there, windy, rainy. Oh. That was a test for a lot of players, and we knew that coming up there. But we obviously, when I was playing there, we moved into the new stadium, the Stadium of Light, which is a fantastic stadium as well. But it's a tough place, as you said, to go up there, especially a midweek game even, Craig. You're asking players to come from down south or middle of the country to go up there. But even for away games, and I'm telling you this, guys, as I've experienced it, we would travel in the Championship or the Premier League, and we would take 7,000 to 8,000 fans away with us for every game.
Yeah.
We were in London on a weekend, and sometimes we took 9,000 to 10,000 fans with us.
Yeah. You know, it made for a great atmosphere, because when we were at Ipswich, and if they brought in all these away supporters like Newcastle, Sunderland, and Middlesbrough, the atmosphere was just dynamite.
Yeah. We're gonna get either a fan on, maybe from one of their forums that I still speak to, or we'll try and get an ex-player on that has been through it as well. And
that'd
still
be great. Well, even the owner, I forget his name now, right now, but he's obviously from the South, and he was saying how he just really underestimated the fan love of that club, and that was his most impressed by. But you know, if you're at any club right now, Craig, if you're at Ipswich right now, and Netflix or Amazon come knocking your door saying, we want to cover you, I think it's a really smart thing to do, don't you? It's building a brand globally. And I think it's just giving that insight into a club that otherwise you wouldn't get. So as much as it might be, I mean, no one expected the Black Cats to descend like they did when they first started shooting that series, the first series. Mm. But wouldn't you be saying, yeah, please come here, cover us.
It's
free promotion.
Yeah, it's free promotion. I mean, I like the fact that they, you know, after they fell from the Premier League, that they covered it as well, and just the hardships of a club that's been relegated. Did they get relegated again? You know, and, you know, I wonder, Danny, too, you know, knowing the Northeast like you do, with the Saudi situation and taking over potentially Newcastle, I don't think that deal is done yet, but it's still on the table, right?
Yeah.
That is so far, they're so far from the heart and soul of the Northeast. And by the way, does the Premier League need any more of this investment from frickin' oil money?
How can they pass the fit and proper persons test?
Right. Really? Like, come on.
My God.
You're basically, countries are buying your frickin' teams right underneath your noses, and you're allowing it. Like, I like the German model. They don't allow any foreign buyers. Like, it's keep it all German. But the Premier League is becoming so far from English.
Yeah.
I mean, Man United hate their owners.
Yeah.
Arsenal hate their owners. Man City, yeah, well, they'll tolerate them. And, get, you know, who cares about human rights and all that? Fuck it, we'll win trophies.
Yeah, no, I mean, they'll rather have this nation with really questionable human rights records over Mike Ashley, who admittedly was a terrible owner. Don't get me wrong, I understand that. But they're a lot of fans, not all of them in fairness, but a lot of fans are prepared to say, yeah, get out of here, Mike. We want these guys. Just shows the fickle nature of fans, right?
Yeah, and how deep their pockets. If Ashley was throwing in $1 billion into the team and they were winning, they would, yeah, okay, he's from London, but okay, we'll like him because. Speaking of London, did you find it when you went to Sunderland you had to prove yourself even more being a Londoner?
Yep.
Yeah.
100%, yeah.
Yeah.
But going back to the new foreign owners coming in, are we missing the fact here that the old owners, and we go back to Sheepshanks at Ipswich, Bob Murray, who was at Sunderland, Harding, that was at Chelsea, certain chairmen and owners from back in the day, they did the actual great job. They had the incentive to say, okay, we're out of this now because the big money's coming, where we can get a nice sum for our club, but we're not going to be able to invest what the Premier League or what the TV want us to invest in these clubs from now on, because the owners coming in are basically vetoed by the TV people and the Prem, who want even more money spent on these Premier League clubs. And you're right, the clubs have lost their identity, in my opinion, Craig.
I agree.
See, that's why Sunderland is so crucial still, because they have that community aspect still. You go to Liverpool now, Shams and Anfield, 60% are Scousers, like born and bred Scousers. And Liverpool is a massive, massive club as well. Man United on a match day, I would even go as low as 40 to 50%.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Like, so a lot of these clubs have not only lost their identity, they've lost their community aspect as well, because...
Well, they've become franchises.
Yeah, there's no connection between the owners like there used to be back in the day when me and Craig played. I'm not using this as a, oh, when we used to play back in the old days, everything was good. I'm just saying that the club have lost an important aspect which really, really pushed on that local community drive and love for the local club.
Yeah, well, football's become local, weren't they? Like, even Walker at Blackburn sunk all his money in, won a title, bought that title.
Yeah.
A lot of good things for Blackburn Football Club, but it's still a tiny market, and that's why they've, without that investment with Walker after he died for the long term, they weren't successful. It's a tough. And then now after this pandemic, what's going to happen to those lower teams? And then the money, we're talking about billionaires are running football now. They're the ones that are going to make the decisions at the end of the day and say, hey, let's have a Super League down the road, you know? And
oh, yeah, it's coming. It's been discussed again this past week, you know, there's been talk of it again. And to me, there goes the soul. I mean, what it's become, football's become this vehicle for these states, not even business companies, states and their overseas brands. That's what they've become, right? It is so far...
Well, it's whitewashing, sport washing, whatever you want to call it.
Exactly,
they can give a positive narrative on a very negative situation in their own country and any bad media. It's unbelievable. And it'll be interesting to see if Newcastle support that, because if they don't support Mike Ashley, how can they support that?
But they will, because they're football fans. And when they listen, we're going to bring in Wolf Zaha for £70 million. And we're going to bring in Neymar. Right. Oh, suddenly, there'll be all these... Geordie's wearing
shirt
outfits.
What happened in Paris? It happened
yeah,
in Paris.
Exactly, right?
Same freaking thing.
The key thing
as well, guys, and I was listening to an Italian podcast talking about the lower league teams in Italy, and there's a situation now where these big-time owners and people with money, foreign investors, are being offered lower league teams to purchase them, because they're basically going to go bankrupt or they're going out of business, with the incentive to actually having a big club in Serie A, but also buying three or four of the smaller clubs, whether it be in Italy, whether it be in Belgium, France.
As opposed to having reserve leagues and stuff?
Exactly. So they're starting to try and get the process of, okay, in England, there's a rule that you can only be involved or own one club. That's right, Craig, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that your investors or people within that company can.
Yeah, that includes players. You can't have multiple ownership of one player. Remember the Tevez situation?
Yeah.
Sheffield United does, that's for sure. maybe that's how the game will change moving forward. You know, these kind of conglomerates owning more than one team, and what happens when those teams start ascending through the leagues? You can't have two teams in one division owned by the same owners, mm-hmm. right?
I don't know what it's like in baseball or basketball or stuff like that, but is there multiple owners through different sports?
No, I don't think so. I mean, MLS and the old North American Soccer League used to have multiple. Remember, MLS had several guy owned. What's his name? He owned three or four teams and supported them, right?
Well, MLSE are probably one of the only organizations that own multiple sport franchises within their company. I don't know if there's any other one similar to MLSE. You got New England, the Patriots are owned by the Revolution.
You mean within the city? Because you got Kroenke, who owns LA Rams, Arsenal.
Then you got John Henry, right? Owns obviously the Red Sox and Liverpool.
I'm talking about
it happens.
In the actual continent,
right? Not within the same sport, I don't think.
No, MLSE are giants, and
remember they were talking about buying Leeds once upon a time years ago. Now that was a big rumor. This is back in the mid 2000s. Yeah, so they're looking
by Leeds, Sunderland.
So what club in world football, world sports, let's put it that way, would you want to see covered by Netflix next. You've seen City. Go ahead.
That's a good one. I like that. Yeah.
Who would interest you? I think the smaller clubs are almost more interesting than the big clubs.
I think you'd have to do it by sport. Like for me, my NFL team are the Oakland Raiders, now the Las Vegas Raiders, and they're an absolute gong show. So they would be pretty good to follow on Netflix.
Yeah. You know, Raiders story would be good. They got a lot of characters. It's all about the characters, really, too, right?
Yeah.
The old New York Cosmos documentary, Once in a Lifetime. Fabulous football documentary.
You watching the Last Dance right now about the Bulls and Jordan?
I start watching the first one, yeah. I mean, it's obviously really, I will.
It's really good, right? But that's a prime example. These characters who are driving this thing. And I love the way that they're looking at it from the point of view of the last season, the last dance, but they're using that as their vehicle to go back in time. And, you know, how did Jordan get into the league? You know, Rob, as I watched last night, it's fascinating stuff. It's so well done.
How crazy was Rodman?
What's that?
How crazy was Rodman?
He was pretty crazy.
He says, Coach, I'm going to need to take a couple of days off a long weekend.
48 hours, yeah.
During the season, Craig, imagine going to your gaffer and saying, Gaffer, I'm feeling a little bit down at the moment. I just want to go to just going to pop into London for the weekend.
You fucking what?
and Jordan goes to Phil Jackson. Hey, Jordan, he wants Phil, to go fucking Phil, London. Let him do it. Just let him do it. He needs it.
48 hours. They couldn't find him after fucking 72 hours.
I wouldn't even ask. You just wouldn't ask.
No.
It's just pointless.
Shows you the difference, huh? Difference.
Yeah. But just, I mean, Jordan, you know, I came here in 1990, right in his prime. So, you know, I was never a huge NBA fan, but I watched the NBA because I watched Michael Jordan. And I don't think there hasn't been anyone like him since in any sport, I don't think, has there? Really? A guy that not only is the biggest brand, but also the best player. You know, you can say Beckham was the biggest brand for a long time, but he was never the best player.
Yeah.
LeBron, I guess, is close, but he's not Jordan, let's be honest.
Ooh, Jordan is what? As a player, you mean? Or is
who combined both, who was that brand, as being the best player.
Yeah. It's easy to get lost in the generations.
It is, sure.
You know, but
who'd be the closest in football? And Ronaldo, I think the original Ronaldo was close. He was the best player in world football.
I tell you what, Pelé was unbelievable. Like, look what Pelé did to the game.
Yeah, he changed it.
Changed it. They got like 5 goals on video that he's ever fucking scored.
Was he a brand, though? I mean, I mean, it's before my time, really. Right, was he... It was before sports became brands, right?
Right. So, but he was one of the. He was probably who else was bigger than him when he just transformed the whole North American soccer league by bringing him to New York in a bad way, because everybody else thought all we have to do is bring a star over and we fill these frickin' massive stadiums. So overcame Rodney Marsh and George Best, and it just went on and on and on.
Yeah.
Vancouver, yeah. Weimark, and all those guys. Just
Thomas Roman.
Thomas Roman, yeah.
Cruyff, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, so Cruyff as well. Yeah, yeah. They came from all over the world.
I used to love talking to Brian Budd about this. You know, Budgie, you know, this no-name Canadian player. You know, he was had caps for Canada, but obviously not a great player. But playing alongside George Best and Pelé and these guys, and his stories were incredible. I mean, what a time to be alive. You're a footballer playing in that league for those few years.
And you had to have two North Americans playing on the field no matter what.
Which is how he got in there, right?
Yeah.
And he's full. Yeah, I wasn't good enough to play in this team, he'd say.
Yeah, but he could just run you to the ground, right?
Yep, exactly.
We got to get Thomas Roman on for a little podcast to tell us about them stories. I remember one story where he says, I'm this young Dutch guy. I'm playing on a team with Cruyff and some other guys. We go out at night and we're in New York and we go to Studio 54. Is that the night?
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah. He said,
there's this lineup, this queue that's going around the block. And I'm there behind Cruyff and
having a smoke.
Was having a smoke, and we're going past the guest list crew, and he says, I'm with, I don't know who was playing back then, but big hitters, and he said, I'm just nestling behind Cruyff, and I'm going through, and we're knocking over Barbara Streisand, we're knocking over Richie, we're elbowing people, and they're looking, who the fuck is that little guy at the back of Cruyff's pack there, and he's like, "Oh, yeah, should I play with the rugby?" So we got to get him on because he's got some great stories from back in the days.
Yeah, remember we did that Fox show together, and he's freaking. We do the whole 20 like minute segments, and then the producer jumps in and says, "We got to do that again." And I'm like, "Why is that?" Well, Thomas keeps calling you Greg. Greg, I was like, "Yeah, because he's freaking Dutch, man. It's like it's okay. I don't care."
Yeah.
They remember said, those round tables? He's got to call you Craig. So he goes, I am calling him Greg.
Teach, remember those round tables at Fox? Those with Tion? Oh, they were so much fun. And it would have to, I mean, he's a great, obviously, great football man, great stories, knows the game so well, but he gets certain things wrong every now and again, terms and names, right? But it was just so much fun. It always flew by those shows.
Was classics, classic time. We had Craig on them round tables a couple of times as guests.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, yeah, exactly. When he graced us with his presence,
which must be Greg.
I helped you guys get jobs.
Yeah, you did.
And you helped us lose our jobs.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, remember Scott Woodgate? He was put in charge of that project, right?
Yeah, former Sportsnet boss.
Yeah, so he obviously he's like comes to me and he's like, "Who should do it?" So I said, "Not Dicchio." Not Charmin. And as Scott Woodgate would do, he friggin' hired you both.
Yeah, and we killed the station.
Yeah, exactly. It lasted about a year. That's too bad. That was a good, really good gig.
Yeah, man, it was a lot of fun. That was. I remember Dunlop was the first guy on air they hired there, and because I was doing the Score, it was during the whole Score Sportsnet acquisition, and poor B had to work. I think it was like 36 days straight. I think he worked and wasn't paid overtime, if I remember, and was just burning out. And then I think they hired Ben Ennis.
Yeah, Ben was on us as well.
He was, yeah. But they were really fun times. But Dunlop, yeah, he earned his stripes, let me tell you, on that show in the early days.
I understand, and I'm not saying this because we're not working on TV or anything at the moment, so no sour grapes, but I just can't understand how there's not a football show, a specific weekly football show on any of the main channels where a group of guests, they do it in the US, where a group of guests, whether it be ex-Canadian internationals, a host, an ex-player from Montreal, Vancouver, whoever it is, comes on and just shoots the shit for an hour. It baffles me how there's not that. We have
you're not thinking about it.
We have everything, like a talk show about everything. Even dogs, we have a talk show about.
But you're not thinking about it from Rogers and Bell, who own TSN and Sportsnet. They're not thinking about creating, producing. They're just thinking about dollars and cents and that's going to cost money and how we get it back. And, oh, no, it might be good investment. It's going to help the sport. They don't give two shits about that.
No, the first question is, okay, what money's coming in?
As opposed
to let's build something.
Hey, Deitch, if we went to SportsCenter or TSN independently and said we want to put the show up and they say, fine, here's the hour slot. You pay us X amount for that slot. We would get the show, but we would have to go out and get advertising and revenue,
we could buy time.
But they would definitely do the show.
And I'm not even talking about us. I'm just talking about.
No, I know. I'm just.
It should be. we have. How long till we have the World Cup in this country, guys?
Yeah.
6 years.
2026. Yeah.
6 years.
Yeah. Okay. Barring another pandemic.
Yeah. But it just baffles me. It's something that I scratch my head about.
Well, listen, I'll tell you what, if there is going to be a weekly soccer show on a network, it ain't going to involve us now, is it? So thanks, fellas, for that. Appreciate it. All right, boys, I think we're out of time. Wonga's been very quiet today. So's Jeff, but I've enjoyed the silence, personally.
I can chime in anytime I want.
There you go. There
fuck you.
What do you got to say, Wonger? What do you got to say for yourself?
I say, if you're listening on the pod, Craig's hair is growing in. It looks a little better. So I think you should show the fellas. Danny Dicchio's beard looks sensational still, 2 weeks after it being dyed. He looks like a character from Ocean's 11. And Sharms, I have to say, looks so pied out. I think if he has another pie, he will look at him. He looks like Andy Capp's shit.
Andy Capp's shit. Wow. Look at this hair, though. I mean, it's out of control now.
Dude, it's been this long since 1993.
Yeah, look. Look at my hair as well.
Jesus. I've got these wings coming out here now. Look at this.
Buzz it, Sean. Buzz it.
You know what?
To anybody who's listening from Rogers and Bell, we're still open to some conversation.
Well, you know what? I'm so naive, right? So I'm thinking,
That's your problem. See?
Now we'll do our own thing, Craigor. We've got other things going on.
I'm naive because I think that if I buzz my hair off, which I'd love to do, trust me, then I'll get a call next week from some television network wanting to hire me. And I'm like, that's not going to happen, really, let's be honest. But I'll be like, oh, that's typical. Now I've buzzed my bloody hair.
You never know.
Charms. I did. What are you talking about?
Hey?
I didn't.
No, but you can
stand like this.
Me with the bust hair, like I've got a lumpy head, right? You've got a good, nice, look at your, it's like a golf ball. It's beautiful. It's a lovely, lovely head. Hey, I don't wear a bald head well.
You never know, Shams. The Food Network might be on the phone for you.
Yeah, that's fair enough, yeah.
Or the mental asylum.
Yeah. Losing my mind during COVID-19. The James Sharman story.
Yeah,
it started so well, you know, and then the hair got long, and I got ridiculed by my mates on Footy Prime, and then it all went down the shitter. Yeah.
Well, you're starting to bore me now. I'm leaving.
Yeah, I'm going to say I'm pretty bored now as well. All right, boys. Well, thank you for that. It's fun. Thanks to Benoit Cheroux.
Yeah, that was great, eh?
Really classy good. Guy, man. Classy guy.
Really, yeah, really good. Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Really good. Great insight. All right.
Is Jeff around still? Wonga for the
no, Jeff's no? Gonna, Jeff took off because of the internet. We wanted to make sure we weren't lagging too badly.
Yeah, we hope it's improved this week. We have internet issues, as everyone is. I'm using a different mic this week as well, so we'll see how it sounds when we post it in a few hours from now. So, Wonga, thank you. Deitch, Craig, thank you very much. As mentioned, thanks to Benoit Cheroux, Amsterdam Brewery. Enjoying the 3-speed at the moment, a delicious crisp pint, very enjoyable. DeanBlundell.com, our home away from home. Thank you very much, Dean. And we'll be back, I guess, same time, same place, probably next week, because nothing fucking's changing right now. Bye.
What up, Primers? JC here. Can't get enough of Footy Prime the podcast? Why not head over to Footy Prime's YouTube? Head to youtube.com/footyprime for exclusive video content. Then make your way over to wearefootyprime.com for all things Footy Prime, including our official gear from Admiral and our One Ball Gin from Nickel 9 Distillery. And make sure to follow and subscribe across all platforms, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to TikTok. Footy Prime has got you covered for all things footy. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the show. Show.